Bronchoscopy Issues, presented now by Justin Tawil, Assistant Professor of Cardiothoracic and Critical Care Anesthesiology, Medical College of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. We recorded Dr. Tawil at the 2019 ARNT Advanced Skills and Airway Management Conference, presented by the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, Department of Anesthesiology, and the University of Wisconsin-Madison Interprofessional Continuing Education Partnership.
All right, well, a lot of my colleagues have already stolen the thunder on this. I don't have any disclosures or financial incentives for being here. I have specifically nothing to do with Katamari Damacy, which we'll talk about later. We'll talk about bronchoscopy. Some of the people that have been up here already have talked about a lot of this stuff, but I'll try to come at it from a little bit of a different perspective. We'll talk about the actual scopes, the patients, and then how to perform these things and their real-life uses and complications. From our perspective, there's a lot of reasons to use a bronchoscope, but a lot less than the pulmonary docs are using them for. So from our perspective, mostly it's about intubation and treating hypoxia when we don't really know what's going on. Your patient's in front of you and hypoxic, and you need to figure out why. Sometimes this is one of the best strategies for you to go in there and fix the problem or diagnose the problem. So we talked about double lumen intubation and lung isolation, and bronchoscopy is required for that as well. We also use them to assist with percutaneous tracheostomies, and then anytime we're doing lung transplants, we're going to evaluate those lungs, and you'll need a bronchoscope for that. And if we're in the ICU, we may need to diagnose some pneumonias or other reasons to be using it there. It's really two main kinds of bronchoscopes. We have flexible and we have rigid bronchoscopes. Flexible bronchoscopy didn't really come around until like the 1960s. Rigid scopes have been around since the 1800s. Rigid scopes are primarily used by surgeons. They're used for treating and diagnosing airway obstructions, whether that's a foreign body or a tumor or an external compression for deploying stents and other things. We don't really use those, but they can definitely help rescue your patients if they're in extremis from an airway compromise situation. The flexible scopes have a little bit of a different anatomy to them. They have a lever on the back that lets you look up and look down, and then they're flexible so we can actually do them without general anesthesia and paralysis. They both have a light source, they both have a working channel, and they both have optics. Initially and originally, they were designed with using fiber optic fibers. You would just really put your eye up to the eyepiece and you'd look through it. Since then, we've come a long way with electronics. Most of the modern techniques and modern devices don't have that kind of fiber optic technology anymore. They have basically what's on the end of your iPhone. It's a little electronic camera, and it's going to transmit electrically, not directly visually. The reason for that is cleaning is a lot easier. You can put these cameras in much more extreme environments than you can fiber optic cables. They're also a bit more durable. The technology has changed over time, but in general, it's all pretty similar depending on which device you're using. We do see that there are some problems with cleaning and infection over the last few years. There have been some case reports initially of colonoscopes and, you know, GI type of scopes that have transmitted some lethal bugs. This hasn't been the case so much for bronchoscopes, though there have been some deaths attributed to inappropriately cleaned bronchoscopes and transmitting multi-drug resistant organisms from one patient to another. Generally, this has to do not with drugs or the cleaning that we do, but sort of variations and violations of protocols or things that, you know, people aren't following the rules that they're supposed to when they're cleaning things. There have been certainly outbreaks of different bugs and water supplies and other things that are associated with the cleaning. You know, most of you who've held a bronchoscope find that most of the parts are disposable now, and a lot of that has to do with worries over infections and cleaning those suction ports and the working channels. But for the most part, you can clean these things very easily with a brush and some soap. They're not sterilized. The cost associated with that takes about 24 hours. So between the time and the resources used, and the concept that these devices are really meant to only come in contact with mucous membranes and not penetrate into sterile spaces means that we don't really have to be as careful with them. But we do also see that some of these bugs like Pseudomonas are rising. We're seeing false outbreaks. What we say a pseudo-infection or an outbreak is basically you're drawing a sample through a contaminated scope. And so you're seeing that you know, 20 people are coming up with this specific Pseudomonas, but really it's just the device that's not been cleaned well. Generally, that's from either an injury to the scope. If it's a little bit broken, then you can't clean all the surfaces, and those sterile parts are not protective and they can't be cleaned. So smart doctors and infectious disease people keeping an eye out for these things. You know, when you see the same bug showing up in multiple people, that high index of suspicion will get you a long way. There are definitely transmissions of tuberculosis, and we'll kind of talk about some other things like that. But for the most part, what people are seeing is lots and lots of Pseudomonas because it can sort of survive a lot of horrible things. You'll see people moving more and more towards reusable scopes in anesthesia, and part of that is a perceived reduction in cost. You also can remove a lot of that processing and those infectious risks. All these different companies make different scopes. They report internal diameters and external diameters. The outer sizes will tell you what tubes you can use them in. And some of these newer devices, the AMBU, I report here, you know, when you push your thumb down, it looks forward. When you push your thumb up, it looks backwards. And usually it doesn't look as far backwards as it does forwards. You can see the AMBUs actually go a bit further than this, and they're probably closer to 200 in the reverse and like 230 in the forward. So you can really look all the way around, forward and backward with that. So that's that. When we're going to take our patient for bronchoscopy, there's a couple of things we need to think about. If we're doing this for intubation, primarily it's going to be good topicalization and preventing bleeding getting in our airways. If you're already intubated, you want to make sure you change your ventilator over, pre-oxygenate them with 100%, keep it on throughout the procedure. I personally prefer the patients to get bag masked. You definitely don't want to be on a pressure control settings. If you introduce that scope into the airway, you're going to add a lot of resistance to the system, and it's going to try to deliver not enough tidal volume. So hypoventilation is really common if you're not using a volume control or a bag mask squeeze. Remember, tube resistance doesn't cause injury to patients. So if you have to squeeze the bag a little harder or ventilate them with higher pressures, the lungs aren't usually seeing those volumes. You may or may not have to paralyze the patient. Usually you'll have to sedate the patient. The better or worse you numb the patient, the less you'll have to use for sedatives. And you want to always plan for your responses to stimulation and sedation. So hypertension is possible, hypotension is possible. Any kind of arrhythmias have been demonstrated. You know, we'll talk a little bit about positioning. So I'm a CVICU doc, so I just always want to remember to put my ECMO on 100% when I'm doing these cases. The ventilator usually isn't my issue. PPE becomes really important as well. We talked about how you can transmit things from patients to patients, but you can also get pretty sick by getting in people's airway who have respiratory distress. We think about the things being transmitted, like measles is very commonly transmitted, and then tuberculosis. So you don't want to be sticking a probe down in these people without having the appropriate PPE on and respiratory precautions in those cases. You're not really going to get sick from people who just have a lobar bacterial pneumonia, but it is important to protect yourself. So this is one of my nurse practitioners in CVICU. The patient is not in isolation, but she's downed appropriately to be invading this gentleman's airway. There's a couple of things worth noting. You know, we have our continuous monitor on. She can't see it, but I can. So we're watching continuous heart rate, blood pressure, oxygen saturations, because we're likely to disturb those things with our procedure. We're also ready for the hemodynamic consequences. In our institution, purples are for uppers and downers. And so, you know, there's sedation in line and there's a readiness for hypotension. She's got her PPE on and tube feeds are on hold, and we've got some oral suction over here. So, you know, really preparing the patient for everything that we're going to expose them to and everything we're going to be exposed to while we do this procedure. She's at the head of the bed. As you're learning how to do this, it's probably best for you to stay up there. It's a little bit easier for you to, you know, keep an eye on the anatomy if right is right and left is left. But it's not required, and my resident is not prepared with the proper PPE, but he's coming at it from the side. So I find it to be more comfortable in general to intubate patients from this position rather than at the head of the bed. At the head of the bed, you know, if they're seated up, it can be a real challenge to get that high yourself. You're standing on a couple of steps, whereas from the side, you don't really have to worry about that too much. But video scopes, they need air spaces. If you are up against the wall, you're just going to see a pink screen. If you don't have a space from which to see, you're just going to see pink. And you can't really navigate and stay off of the walls and get where you want to go if you can't see. So it's important that you create those air spaces. And the ways to do that are with a simple jaw thrust, grabbing that tongue, pulling it out anteriorly to open some space up if you're not going to use an airway. There's a bunch of great airways. The Ovisapien, the Berman, the Williams, they all have sort of different strengths and weaknesses. The Berman and the Williams, they will get you behind the tongue and they'll create a little bit of space from the posterior pharynx and they'll open forward. The Williams is going to help lift the tongue out of the way. So a lot of these things will help you to create those air spaces, but there's really not a lot better than an LMA for this purpose. So not this particular LMA, because you're probably not going to get through those slits with your endotracheal tube, but LMAs are great. They get you behind the tongue. They create a space for you to see through. And if you can, you know, maneuver them to be able to find the larynx, you're going to be in good shape. Everybody starts, you know, using suction, and suction is a great way of helping clear secretions from your patient. If your patient is paralyzed, you can consider, you know, hooking that suction port up to oxygen. This is not recommended in patients who are spontaneously ventilating and not paralyzed, because there's lots of case reports of people spraying the cords with whatever goo was in their mouth and causing laryngospasm and having major problems. But this can be helpful when you're doing those asleep fiber optics. You know, this is a hand-eye coordination game. If it's not something you've done much of, it's really easy to tell who's played video games and who hasn't. You know, you're using a lot of gross motor skills and then also some fine motor skills, and you're using real-time visual feedback to figure out what you're going to do with your hands. Not everybody has a simulator in their office or in their institution. This is a game called Katamari Damacy. I definitely have loaned my PlayStation to my residents and my nurse practitioners to practice this when it's really obvious that they need some work on their hand-eye coordination. It's all about thumbs and using your visual feedback to figure out how to get on the screen where you want to go. You know, it doesn't always have to be in a medical simulation, but the American Thoracic Society and pulmonary groups have very, very large numbers that they require their residents to graduate with. I think it's like 200 bronchoscopies are required. In anesthesia training, you know, almost nobody has that kind of experience. And really, once you get out and you're practicing, I doubt that many people are doing more than 10 or 20 of these a year. So, you know, just practicing as much as you can is really helpful. It's a great start. Once you've done with the video games and you're ready for the real thing, got to reach out and pick this thing up. Most people will be tempted to reach out with their dominant hand and grab that scope because it seems like that's where all the action is. But I would recommend, if you haven't gotten used to doing this yet, that you use your non-dominant hand. When you're turning left and right, those are really gross motions. And the same thing with your thumb. It's a really broad, not a very careful motion. It's pretty large movements. You're going to want your dominant hand free to either be managing the tube, pushing drugs, or working that working port if you're needing to get samples for BALs or really do a therapeutic bronchoscopy. The way to do this is to stay off the walls. As we enter the bronchus, as we enter the trachea from an endotracheal tube, you know, you're going to see the screen. And our bronchoscope is really going to want to go right to the middle of the screen every time, no matter what you do. So there's sort of this 12 o'clock area and the 6 o'clock area that you can control with your thumb. So you kind of want to get your area of interest in the middle of the screen. And the way you do that is with your left and your right. So keep the middle of the airway in the screen. Turn till you've got it either in the center, at the top, or at the bottom. Use your thumb to bring it to the center and then advance and just repeat that. Once you get into the area you're trying to go to, you're going to turn, you're going to thumb, and you're going to advance. Some other sort of beginner tricks are really to avoid slack in the line. The difference is that if you have slack in the line, as you turn left or you turn right, you're going to start to store that up in line instead of transmitting it to the tip where you want to turn left and right. If you have these big loops, your motions are going to get stored, and then, you know, they're going to break free and make these huge turns that you're not trying to make. So be conscious. Bring the bed all the way down to the floor if you're behind them, because it's hard to hold this thing up here. If you have the bed all the way down, you're more likely to have less slack in the line and keep it straight. So be conscious of that extra line there. and stay off the walls, right? So, you know, we're going to aim for the center of the screen. That's where we're going to want to go when we push forward. So, you know, use the left and the right to put it at the top or the bottom, and then use the thumb to bring it in the center. I don't know if anybody saw this in the New England Journal. This was a patient who was a VAD, had a bunch of pulmonary edema, and then coughed out his entire right bronchus that was filled with bloody pulmonary edema. I'm not really going to teach you all guys all the 18 segments alone because I don't think it's particularly helpful. That's something you can memorize on your own. There's lots of good YouTube channels to talk about it. I prefer the iBronch. It's like a $2 app on the Apple Store. Again, I'm not affiliated with it, but I think it's a pretty good thing for your iPad or your iPhone. Yeah, so there's 8 on the left and 10 on the right because there's a heart on the left that kind of crushes where your middle lobe would be. There are some things you should know. Some of these people have touched on this. There are definitely some carinas that can be confusing. If you end up down one side or the other, you're going to see a bifurcation in front of you, and you may be confused thinking that's the main stem. So the first things we're going to look for is which way is anterior and which way is posterior. You've got these little rugae on the bottom here, and these guys are always going to be posterior. The esophagus is on the other side of this. And then you've got your rings, which are going to be anterior. I'm a little bit deep. You can't quite see all the rings, but these rugae are telling you that this is really going to be posterior. So that tells you this is, you know, the right side and this is the left side. And you can actually see the right upper lobe starting to take off here. This is one of the most reliable visualized spots in a person is the right upper lobe, that Mercedes-Benz. So this is your apical, your posterior, and your anterior segments. When you're placing your double lumen tubes, this is what you want to see. You want to find this guy. Sometimes it comes directly off the trachea. Sometimes it's off of, you know, the right. This is why this can be a challenge to place a right-sided tube and be able to ventilate this area. There are a couple of spots that it's really easy to tell when somebody's trying to get into them. If you can see how awkwardly she's turning to the left here, that she's got the whole thing turned all the way around. And then the same thing on the other side. You know, these are probably going to be the superior segments of the lower lobe. Which brings me to this point. Now, if you're not using a reusable scope, some of these have a little dial down here. So you got your suction port up here, which you attach to suction. You got your working port down here. But there's a little dial right here that you can twist left if you want to turn left. There's twist right if you want to turn right. And that can be really helpful when you're trying to get into these really angular left and right airways. We can use them for diagnosis. We can use them for therapy. Lots of times we're treating mucus plugging. This is, you know, left upper lobe has gone down with some bleeding. We're clearing out lots of blood from these guys. And that's usually what I'm seeing in the CVICU is bleeding and blood clots. But we also see lung transplantation. You can see some well healing, you know, urine asthmatic areas that you want to evaluate as you're getting further out from surgery for healing. Can also look at your endotracheal tube placement. So go down and find that carina, grab your bronchoscope, pull it back, don't let go until you see the tube, and then that's how far you are above the carina. If you are dealing with lots of mucus plugging, you can inject all kinds of things or to try to open things up. Or if you're having bleeding, epinephrine in that 1 to 10 mic per ml is great, will stop a lot of bleeding. We will use it in the ICU for lots of things, for diagnosing pneumonia. There's other things that you should really be careful of. You know, don't do these things. Don't biopsy things. Don't laser things. Please call somebody who knows what they're doing. Most of these things are going to be separately credentialed. If you were to see something and want to take a bite of it because you know it's not supposed to be there, don't do that. Call a friend. Your pulmonologist will come and help you with that stuff. When we talk about pneumonias, you know, there are protected brushes. There is BAL. But most of the data will say, unless you're really worried about pneumocystis, TB, or fungus, that tracheal aspirates are just fine. That bacteria is generally diffuse and it can be located from just blind sampling pretty reliably. Be aware that the lidocaine you use to make the patient more comfortable may inhibit some of that growth and may cause you to have some false negative sampling. Using sort of 60 mLs is reasonable for if you're going to be doing some washing. If you're really trying to get into distal airways, you have to use a bit more fluid. I would say I've never instilled 120 mLs of fluid in before trying to suck it out. So don't hurt people. There's really one prospective study that looked at the complications as a result of bronchoscopy. They got about 1,000 people and they followed them out for 24 hours. Most of these patients were being treated by pulmonologists as outpatient bronch. These were not your emergent anesthesia patients or your ICU patients. But what they reported was an overall 1% to 3% complication rate. Keep in mind that these people were doing procedures. They were biopsying things, they were lasering things, they were really not just taking a look. They were doing more advanced therapies. So when you really look at what problems they saw, you know, there was one patient who died out of a 908. Hypoxia, hypercarbia, and hemodynamic changes were the most common things. These patients were, for the most part, being sedated. You know, you were going to hypoventilate a patient who's being sedated without a controlled airway. And even if they do have a controlled airway, that bronchoscope in the tube may cause you to mechanically ventilate them less than you mean to and cause some hypercarbia. You're also going to be sucking out the PEEP, and, you know, you can have major airway issues if you don't have a secure airway. Pneumothorax was actually pretty common when biopsy was involved. But if you weren't biopsying, it's extremely rare. So, you know, we consent people generally, pneumothorax, bleeding, you know, more surgery. But when we're talking about all comers having complication rates of less than 0.5%, if you're not doing invasive procedures, it's very safe. Lots of people are aspirating if they're not having protected airways. You know, if people are really fighting you, if they're not cooperative and they're not well sedated and they're coughing and throwing up, you're going to have problems. So really good sedation, making sure the patient is topicalized and or paralyzed, you're more likely to do well with a paralyzed patient than somebody who's actively fighting you. Bleeding was mostly associated with tumors or invasive procedures. There are definitely some case reports of local anesthetic toxicity, but there's also some other reports saying that you can give people 1,200 milligrams of lidocaine without having these problems, even though you're right on that mucous membrane. Once I was called to the ICU to change out an endotracheal tube because the surgeon had somehow flipped the bronchoscope 180 degrees and was looking right back up at us, just like you'd see in a gastroscope, and just couldn't pull it out with a liver transplant patient with platelets of 42. So, you know, be careful. Know what you're doing. Inexperience is one way to really hurt people. So make sure you're careful. Make sure you're staying off the walls and don't push real hard on anything. And as an outpatient, these were the risk factors that they identified for putting people at higher risk for these complications. But honestly, a lot of these things we don't have control over. So sure, if you're on mechanical ventilation, you have PEEP and you're doing biopsies, you're going to have problems. But if you're dealing with a hypoxic patient in the operating room, you got to do what you got to do. And that's pretty much all I have to say.
Thank you, Dr. Tawil. For information about other CME activities from the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, Department of Anesthesiology, visit anesthesia.wisc.edu. And for information about upcoming CME meetings we're recording around the country, visit our website, audiodigest.org, and click on the Inside Audio Digest tab at the top of the page on your dashboard.